Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Well, it's been funny, and as you all know, that's the reason it's hard to write jokes about it, because politicians are providing the punchlines themselves. It doesn't really give you much room to manoeuvre.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve every aspect of your business and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is a comedian and political commentator who takes pride in breaking the norm. He is a self-proclaimed right-leaning comedian whose work is side-splittingly funny and politically poignant. He has been featured on shows like Live at the Apollo, The MASH Report, Question Time and The Daily Politics, just to name a few. His show, What Most People Think, is a punchy and political podcast that gets to the bottom of what he feels the average person thinks about key political issues, and includes interviews with comedians, politicians and journalists. He's one of the few British comedians, save for Boris Johnson, openly mixing conservatism with comedy. Jeff Norcott, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
It's great to be here. I mean, it's been certainly with politics over the last year.
Well, yeah, I was going to say that must be quite tricky for you because, I mean, it's been a whirlwind. So what is your opinion of what's happened in this recent whirlwind?
Well, I mean, I've always had, you know, digs at both sides, you know, of the political dividing line, because I think people wouldn't take you seriously, or you'd have no credibility as a comic if you didn't. And, you know, the Tories over the last year in particular have been providing all the best setups, really. I mean, when you talk about, when you have literally someone says that Boris Johnson was ambushed by cake, you just think, well, there's nothing. I mean, people often say, well, it must be a great time for satirists. But actually, I think that this period now where we're sort of entering into what people call the boring period, we've got two very technocratic figures like Starmer and Sunak sort of trying to outbland each other, really. I mean, it's like, it's sort of like, as I said this on Twitter, but it's sort of like a whole series of MasterChef where you can only use dry cereal and poultry. You know, there's nothing. It's just like, well, I see your flavourless risotto, and I raise you some porridge. It really is. I mean, but that to me, that's funny to me. I can get my teeth back into that. I think the fact that Starmer is sort of, it seems like a mortgage salesman that suddenly decided he wants to run one of the biggest countries in the world. All that is, that to me, that stuff's funny.
Yeah. Do you think that we were in a sense spoilt with characters before, and probably what we do need is a little bit of dullness? Or do you think politics can ever be the same again? Do you think you have to be charismatic to do it now?
Yeah, I'm not so sure. I mean, you get this sort of view in particularly sort of online liberal circles where they're like, you know, we need the grown-ups back in charge. And that in itself is a funny phrase to me, because you don't really get to decide yourself whether or not you're one of the grown-ups. That's something that the electorate will sort of decide for you. But I don't know. I think that I don't see why it's beyond comprehension that you could have a bit of charisma and competence. What we seem to come down to is the idea that it's either an obviously unreliable and dishonest person like Boris Johnson, or it's a deeply tedious but trustworthy person like Starmer. I think that politically he can be deceitful in his own way. I don't think he's a deceitful person. I'd still like to believe that you could combine both things. You know, it almost feels like overcorrecting. It's like, you know, if a woman's in a relationship with a guy that's an absolute wrong'un, and then the next bloke she dates will be the most boring guy you've ever met in your life, you'd think, well, you know, you could have sort of split the difference a little bit.
So who do you think in the past has managed to actually do that balance between being competent and charismatic?
I think Blair, obviously. I think Cameron did as well, to a point. It's sort of forgotten in the mix with Cameron that his unpopularity never, I mean, I know it's a negative way of measuring it, but it never got that high. You know, even when he left office, people didn't dislike Cameron because he was able to communicate. He's quite convincing in a way. I think Thatcher to a different degree. Harold Wilson as well, you know, had his own form of charisma. So yeah, I don't think it's necessarily an either or, but that's the way it's currently being portrayed. It's almost like medicine. We have to have the boring guy now because of all the fun that we had with Boris. I'm not sure we did. I'll take issue with the idea that Boris was as fun as people said. I don't think he was particularly humorous or witty at the dispatch box, but that is the dichotomy as it's being presented now.
Do you think that's ultimately done damage to the Conservative brand, that you know, you had Boris Johnson, who was writ large across it for a while? Do you think that ultimately that will backfire?
I think that, I mean, he had obvious appeal in some places, as evidenced by the fact that even though it seemed like him losing his job was the obvious thing, their polling slump since then has never recovered. I think probably you get your kind of centre-right Lib Dem types that once in the past might have voted for Cameron, maybe, but Boris was a step too far for them. And then you throw in I think the competence stuff is as important as anything. So, you know, for Middle England, you can talk all you like about Boris's dishonesty, Partygate, Pinchergate, all the gates. But the truth was that for a while they had somebody in charge in Liz Truss who made their mortgage get more expensive, or certainly contributed to the speed at which it got more expensive. And really, if we're honest, that's the thing that really gets voters sort of changing allegiances.
Yeah. And do you think that those changing allegiances, the shift has already happened? Have people made their mind up? Or do you think that boring Rishi, as you paint him, will be able to drag them back?
You know, once upon a time, I remember in 1992 when Black Wednesday and Britain came out of the European exchange rate mechanism, which eventually proved to be a good thing, I think. But at the time, it didn't feel like that. The voters didn't forget that for a long time. And I would normally say that what happened last year wouldn't be easily forgot. But I do think we're living in a sort of state of social media induced temporary amnesia, whereby I think it could be, once upon a time, that would have meant there was absolutely zero chance you could win an election. I don't know now. The, you know, 20 points Labour are generally ahead on average. If I had to bet on it now, I'd bet on a 50 to 80 seat Labour majority. I don't think it's going to be as big as some people are saying, but I can't see anything other than a Labour win.
Well, I don't know. I'm confused as anyone at the moment. Yeah. Politics seems to be able to swing violently from one thing, because, you know, nobody was expecting an 80 seat majority for Boris Johnson at the time, were they?
Anyway, the Tories probably are wishing that they could do another Brexit at this point. They just, if we could Brexit again, you know, a sort of sequel, because that election, it was a very easy sort of sell, wasn't it? This thing that probably realistically, once the vote happened, that you had to do in some form, right? You could argue about how hard or how mild the Brexit was. But the point where Labour are, I mean, And this was interesting. I was on Mass Report at the time, and I was doing a bit about Labour's Brexit position. And I was getting to the point of making a joke about it, which was, but first I had to say what Labour's position was, which was that they would renegotiate a Brexit deal. They would put it to a referendum for the British people, which they would then campaign against. And before I did the joke, everyone was laughing because it was just so stupid and ridiculous. It was, you know, the product of a committee. But you sort of think, well, they're just, it's not a position... at all. So yeah, I mean, sometimes when it comes to politics, humor is, you know, in cases like that, sometimes it's literally a case of restating what happened.
So we're in order to Brexit again, Britain will have to leave Britain, won't it?
I mean, that could happen too. I mean, there's, you know, Wales could leave Britain, Scotland could leave Britain. There we might, you know, Brexit is now a brand. It's like a franchise, like the Fast and the Furious.
Oh God, we're going to get 13 of them.
Maybe.
Oh, dear. You grew up in Southwest London. Actually, we both grew up in Southwest London on an estate where I believe, from your excellent book, they filmed the chase scenes for The Bill. And your dad was a proud union man and your mother, by all accounts, was a formidable matriarch. Was humour actually valued in your family?
Well, I think... And this is, I mean, the middle-class people have a different version of humour, but I think that if humour, if you define it as a coping mechanism, a sort of a smile in the face of chaos, I think that the more difficult your life is, I think the more important humour becomes. I certainly think in South London, you'll know this, there's a way of talking. That every region has their own kind of humour, sort of specialities, and there's a sort of an exasperation. Banter is such a horribly overused word, but there's a particular way that people speak to each other in South London. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned my mum there. I mean, my dad used to do public speaking as a trade union man, but actually, and people always presume the humour would come from him, but my mum was inherently funny as a person. You know, she was very charismatic woman, but she was also quite unreasonable in some ways, and you know, she was very sniffy, judgmental, you know. And when we moved to the council estate, it was after the divorce that my mum and my dad had, but we were living quite a middle class life at that point, and the standard thing that should have happened was being that my mum sort of took him for the house, but she didn't really want him to give her anything, so she left him with the house and went to a council estate, which is the absolute opposite of the divorce mantra of the 80s, which was take him for everything he's got, and hers was leave him with everything and live in a two-bedroom council flat. I mean, but I have to admire her for it, because her thing was, you know, maybe this is why I believed in Brexit, was sometimes you've got to exit a partnership, and even if in the short to medium term, I can hear the Remainers switching off now, but the independence has a value, you know, and certainly that was the way that she saw it. But it was undeniably, possibly like Brexit, an eccentric decision.
Well, an eccentric decision that has consequences for, you know, I mean, I heard Jacob Rees-Mogg say that it in 40 years' time, we'll be laughing about it and saying what a wonderful thing it was. Do you believe that as well? Do you believe that we should put that much people through that much pain in order to come out the other end just for what you describe as independence?
Well, I feel like the Remainer you has come out a little bit here.
No, but I'm also here to, you know, this is a thing about humour. So I want to see the humour side of it.
No, I mean, like, so this is sometimes what I cover in the podcast is that the perception was indeed that Jacob Rees-Mogg said we won't. I mean, the way it was portrayed was that he said we won't see a single benefit for 50 years. What he actually said was the benefit will become apparent as our new trading relationship evolves across 50 years. But one thing I'll give credit to is that left wing online movement is very good at pulling quotes out of context. It's not, you know, for me to, but I mean, trust me, there isn't much in me that really wants to launch an impassioned defense of Jacob Rees-Mogg. But what I do, you know, I've sort of, you know, become particularly political in a time of social media. And what I do object to is the way that sometimes things get pulled out of context. You know, there's a popular way of understanding stuff. I mean, personally, when it comes to Jacob Rees-Mogg, I think that there was a time on the backbenches when he was You thought, well, he represents a part of England. I mean, I don't know if there's many people like him, but I've met eccentrics like him at church. You know, there are people like him in Britain. The point where he was part of the cabinet, you sort of thought he's gone mainstream. You know, eccentric contributions from the back bench are very different from a guy like that having control over how the country's run on a day-to-day basis. And often with Rees-Mogg, it just seemed to become like a kind of parlour game for him of, can I defend Boris Johnson again? You know, oh, well, no, actually, I think he'll... No, well, the thing is, no, he never said... And he'd go, all right, mate, you know. I know that this would have been great fun at whatever weird boarding school you went to, but this is real life now. So I mean, I come at things... It's a strange thing is where, you know, on a subject like Brexit, like the sort of superficially, he and I wanted the same outcome. But I find myself agreeing on one thing with somebody that I have literally nothing in common with in any other sense.
It's really interesting because we're talking about Jacob Rees-Mogg, and the next thing I was going to talk about was schools. And I suddenly went, well, you know, Jacob Rees-Mogg, Boris Johnson, they're schools. And we were talking about charisma and confidence. And now I'm pretty certain that nobody who went to your school or my school became prime minister. And yet 20 people who went to Eton became prime minister. How?
I've stopped. Somebody who went to my school did become prime minister.
Genuinely.
I mean, in many ways, John Major. So anyway, you know, it was, I went to a comprehensive school in South London. Now, this is where perhaps, you know, like why it's unexpected that I ended up voting the way that I did, is that I went to a school where when I was, you know, 14, around 1991, a guy who I knew had gone to my school became leader of the country, and I knew that he was a working class lad who lived in Brixton, and so when the Tories went to that 1992 campaign, you know, the standard thing, which was that if you were working class you voted Labour and if you weren't you voted Tory, was challenged immediately because they had a campaign that said, what did the Tories do with a working class boy from Brixton, .. they made him prime minister. So I know that that is the exception that proves the rule, and what you say generally is correct, but maybe this is why I ended up in the weird place I did, because I just had an unusual path through my early life. Now, it was interesting with John Major was that he was not obviously charismatic, was he? I mean, he came to my school to do a speech night because it had a grammar school pass. So it had some weird vestiges of this kind of thing. And by all accounts, he stood up and basically slagged off his time at Rutledge, said he didn't enjoy it. He got terrible grades. And the head teacher at the time, he must have thought he'd scored a real coup with the prime minister coming to do a speech night. I must have been thinking, all right, John, get back on message, mate. But one thing that did stand out from that night, and this was interesting, was a lot of the lefty teachers who had gone, right, I'm gonna give him a piece of my mind. They all met him and he charmed the pants off them. And, you know, particularly with John, with what we found out, you know, in subsequent years, was that he was of particular interest to the female teachers. They were all said that he was surprisingly charming and attractive, and that he was over 6 foot and had a quite big built man, contrary to the image on spitting image of a tiny grey man. And at the 92 election, John Major did really well with female voters.
Oh, well, that's fascinating, actually. And, you know, at Wandsworth Comprehensive, nobody. So maybe, you know, we should... I'm a bit bitter now that Rutledge got a prime minister and we didn't. I loved your Radio 4 show, Well Classy, which I think everybody should look up. And you're talking about your battles or resenting being called middle class. And you talk about the concept of class treachery for many who grew up without money. I mean, I did love your line, by the way, and it stuck with me. People who have gone from salt of the earth to Himalayan rock salt. You know, it's a brilliant line. But do you think that that's part of the thing, is that in British culture, people, with the exception of John Major, know their place too much and are kowtowing to the Jacob Rees-Moggs and people like that?
I see it slightly differently, in that people like their place. I like, you know, it's weird. I don't, when I look at billionaires, wealthy people who went to boarding school, there's never been any part of me that actively wants their life. I might might be nice to have a few more quid in the bank. But if you ask me which of my life experiences I'd trade, I really have any that I would trade overall for that life. And I think that it's you know, there are compensations, aren't there, at every stage. I've always felt a working class culture is warmer. I think in family life, there's a greater spirit towards disclosure in working class families. We tell each other everything. You know, if you look at the standard dinner table, the things that get discussed, from people's sex life to everything. And, you know, I mean, I remember the first times when I was a kid going to my middle class friends' houses and how uptight they were and how silent everything was. I mean, this is one thing I've noticed when, you know, for example, I do work at places like the BBC. You go into these big open plan offices and just everyone is just padding around and no one's taking the mickey out of each other. No one's got funny nicknames for each other. And I just, you know, that these, I think the cultural class divides are as important as the economic ones, to be honest. And the cultural ones, I would always say I'd prefer, you know, the background that I had, you know, economically. I mean, would it have been nice? There's no part of me that wants to go skiing. I've got to be honest. And you know, I mean, even just earlier today, I went into town where I live and, you know, there was a coffee shop there and I had some work to do. And the standard thing is you go in a coffee shop, you get a latte and you do all that stuff. And then I just really didn't feel like it. And then I saw a cafe next door and I went in the cafe and you know, it's just where are you more comfortable? I feel comfortable in a cafe, but also I guess there's a nostalgia element that smell of, you know, oil and fried foods and stuff. It reminds me of being a kid. And I guess there must have been something about that life which I like, because I like being reminded of it.
It's really interesting because opposites, the Humorology podcast, it's about humour and where humour comes from. And you're very much about that. The banter, for want of a better word, and the humour comes more from working class things. And I think that's true, because I think, you know, great comedy comes out of, you know, all the port cities, which were generally poor, had much more, you know, you didn't get a lot of great comedians coming from, you know, middle Surrey. You got Glasgow, well, you got Liverpool or a thing. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I mean, if I stop and think about like some of the who I think are the best practitioners of stand-up, just pure and applied stand-up, you go Billy Connolly. I think Kevin Bridges is just a world-class talent. You know, you think about the people that broke out at the beginning of the 2010s, you know, Sarah Millican, John Bishop, Mickey Flanagan, you know, Michael McIntyre slightly different, like, but the cartoonish like element, I mean that is who he is, but like there's a slightly cartoonish element to his middle classness that it needs to be funny. So I think when you're sort of playing to a mass audience, there is something about people from a working class background. I mean, if you look in the States, somebody like Bill Burr, you know, people like that have always been Eddie Murphy. People I sort of respond more to that because I don't know, it's a bit more earthy, it's a bit more real. And like, you know, you say about the banter element, I mean, that is mainly I'm taking the piss, you know, in almost everything that I do is I don't really have, I'm not trying to peddle a view that I think people should have. It's just, there'll be a subject. And I've noticed perhaps a little bit of chink in the armor of how people think, you know, and often for me, the sort of virtuous middle-class left-wing types tend to be my favorite hunting ground, because it's just funny, you know, it's just funny to me that often the same people that will talk about doing the right thing and having a moral conscience will be the exact same ones that will kind of, you know, rent a flat near a school just to get their kid in there to avoid, you know, like there's just so many. And everyone wants to do the best for their kids, but I've always found it funny, the sharp elbows of the middle classes. And I have, over the last 10 years, probably gone at them a bit much sometimes, you know, and that's what's funny is like the self-loathing to me. There's no doubt my life's become way more middle class, but to me, the comedy thing about that is the self-loathing element and the trying to hang on, you know, and I guess even today, defiantly putting my laptop down in a cafe and, you know, next to the workman, and there's me with my MacBook Pro thinking somehow I'm still a proper geezer, but I'm just writing jokes, you know.
Wait. Well, you talk about proper geezer. Your new tour is called Basic Bloke. Tell us a little bit more about that and where is that the dichotomy of, are you still a basic bloke, even though you now have middle class, you are able to have a MacBook Pro?
Yeah, I mean, I think with, you know, with the show, obviously blokes generally, you know, in the slipstream of something like Me Too, which was a legitimate movement against some really bad people. But what tended to happen then was that masculinity and maleness, it all got pulled into the slipstream of one thing. And then eventually, like, male sort of became a pejorative for naff, rubbish, useless, you know. And I sort of thought, you know, I think blokes are all right generally. There are obviously the toxic men that need to be taken on. But what you had was a lot of other blokes that were just a bit lazy and a bit rubbish, you know, at worst, standing around just hearing our brand get absolutely bashed. And I think that, you know, we're often portrayed as being primitive and basic creatures. But I started to think that even some very simple behaviours had more interesting underbellies. Like, for example, you know, blokes generally don't put on suntan lotion as much as women, you know, have to be bullied into it almost. Yeah. And I was thinking, well, you could just say on a simple level, that's because they're lazy. But then I started to think, well, why is that? And then I started, well, one of the reasons I don't like doing it in public is because I don't moisturize very often. I don't really check my body at all. You know, I'm not as in tune with my body as a woman would be. So at the point where I put on suntan lotion in public, I've got no real match fitness in terms of how you reach that bit on your lower back, you know, how you rub stuff in. And so I just look like an idiot while I'm doing it. And so I thought that's more interesting to me, is that it's not just about bravado. It's just that I just don't know how to do that stuff. And it's probably only twice a year that I'll be called upon to do it. So I'll sort of take my chances with skin cancer rather than, you know, the problem is if you try and do something like that, you look like a cat. You know, when a cat has to lick that bit just underneath its chin, it's the only moment that a cat loses its sense of grace.
There's no dignity there, is there?
There's no real dignity. And so I sort of thought that's true of, you know, of men. We just don't really have any form when it comes to a self-care in a public setting.
Well, we had Ahmed Jalili on the show, and he said that comedians are people who need the laughter of strangers to validate us. Mm. We're all mentally ill. You're about to go out on, or you're going on tour. Is that something that you relate to? I mean, because it reminds me of the old Billy Crystal line of what he said about Robin Williams. He needs those extra little hugs that you can only get from strangers.
Mm.
Do you recognize that?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm not like, I don't have like the classic comedians sort of sensibilities. I'm quite sociable. I like going out and doing things. You know what I mean? I've always, like, you know, since I've been a comic, I like getting up in the morning. And, you know, a lot of comics, they're quite, you know, they like going to bed late, getting up late, just keeping themselves to themselves. So I'm not sure that I'm, you know, I mean, maybe it's to do with greatness as well. You know, if you're to be a proper comic, maybe you need that. But I did notice, weirdly, during the first lockdown, I didn't miss the live work. And that sort of alarmed me and my wife. Oh, I think for her, it's a great way of just getting some time apart. But then in the second one, I really, like, the main one at the beginning of 2001, I did miss it. 21. I think the reason I didn't miss it the first time around is because I'd been touring a lot in the build-up and I was just exhausted. So it kind of came, you know, at a convenient time for me, as much as a world pandemic can be convenient. And then I did a run at the Edinburgh Festival last year of my last tour show, which it was the best show I've ever done. I know comedians always said that, but coming out of COVID, we all had a lot of stuff to talk about, right? That's one thing that works for humour, is just accessibility. Do people know the thing that of which you speak? That's why stuff about school works well, stuff about parents. It's simply because I know what he's talking about. So we'd all gone through COVID, whether you'd had the vaccination or hadn't. I had, despite appearances. A lot of people seem to presume that I hadn't. You know, you were talking about a known entity to a lot of people. And then by the time I did it at the Edinburgh Festival, I just loved doing the show. Like, it worked so well. And I did it for 21 days or something. And then after I finished, I just got a bit depressed. And I was trying to think, what is this? And I was like, oh, it's just, I really liked doing that. I liked, my life made sense. I got up, there was a bit, you know, from waking up to about 3 p.m. where the day was my own. I pottered about, did a few bits. And then, you know, I had an early evening show. Which meant that, you know, I could do the show. And then after, I was going to go and get a bit of dinner, basking in the afterglow of this show that I'd worked so hard on. And I missed it. I missed it a lot. And I think that it is weird. I mean, a lot of comics will talk about it is like an addiction in a way, is that the highs get lower and the lows get higher. So what you get from doing your job well versus what you get from doing it badly becomes disproportionate. But the thrill of doing new stuff that works, that doesn't change, I don't think. I mean, it's like you've invented a new sort of really cool weapon for yourself, you know, like a good weapon that doesn't hurt people, that fires fun bullets. And you did that, you know, and you know that the old one is running out of bullets. So you always need. And I think that creative need in stand-up is what keeps me, you know, on my toes, is that you've always got to be developing as an act. Cause I just think, you know, any stand-up you've ever seen that stood still, that is a sort of creative death in itself. Well, it would be for me anyway.
It's interesting you talk about the stood still, because I mean, we both are, I mean, I was obviously a lot earlier version of the Comedy Store and all that than you were. But I, you know, occasionally I will see acts who are still doing pretty much the same act that they were doing. And I always think, well, that must just be, you know, like a factory job at that point when you're doing that. You sound like you really always need to be doing something new to feel vital.
Well, I mean, it struck me even in the early days. So you remember the circuit in the noughties was you could still earn a very good living from it. And so there was venues like the Comedy Store, still is the Comedy Store, a great venue, but Jonglers also, which provided a lot of work. And the culture generally, mostly, was that people did the same 20 for a very long time. But even then, I just found that there was a kind of a shelf life for everything I was saying. And as much as, I, you know, it still worked, there started to come a point of diminishing returns. And so, you know, the acts of generation above me was like, you're always turning stuff over, you know. And then I would say that the acts younger than my generation turn stuff over even quicker. So, you know, there is a danger of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, definitely, you know, because you never know for certain. What you've got to ask yourself is the new stuff, if you're talking just about your 20-minute set, is it definitely better than the old stuff? And sometimes it's not. Sometimes you just want to have new stuff to say. But that was what, in a way, led me to talk about politics, I suppose, was that, you know, I was doing a lot of club-type work. I was gigging for the troops, you know, overseas and in Afghanistan. And that demanded very, like, you know, meat and two veg-type comedy. And I thought, I'd like to do something that challenges me. And my wife sort of said, well, you know, you voted Conservative. That's weird for a comedian. Why don't you talk about that? And I was like, all right, I'll give that a go. And it created a difficulty element in the room, because there were probably a lot of people in the room had voted Conservative too, but the people that hadn't immediately thought I was a bad person, right? Like, as they often do. And you know, so I had to then, I didn't have to make them think I was a good person, but I had to have jokes that were funny enough to make them laugh despite that.
Now, I love the fact that challenge. I also love your quote that voting Conservative is a bit like buying a James Blunt album. Loads of people have done it, but weirdly, you never meet them. So but you were actually setting yourself up, and great comedy comes from. And I remember Kim Kinney, who used to run the Comedy Store. I don't know if you.
I'm aware of him. Yeah.
Yeah. And he, you know, a lot of people like Sean Locke and everything, he advised all of us. And one of the things he used to say is, when people were starting out early in their career, he did it with Jack D and thing, I don't know who you are. And it was a very wise thing to say, go away and work on who you are. And thing. And do you think that through line about your politics gave the audience and you a real signal of who you are and where you're coming from?
First of all, you know, when it came to Comedy Store, they said to me they didn't know who I was, but that was because they just literally didn't know who I was. I wasn't doing enough work. See, always working, Paul, always working. There is a tendency in comedy, and a lot of male comics do this, is they'll just tell you what they think about the world, right? But you're only giving away dribs and drabs, really, of who you are there. You know, they've got to kind of work it out. You get credit for being, that was a smart take or something, but they don't necessarily know who you are. Whereas I guess if you're, even the act of willing to be unpopular tells them something about you. You know, the honesty of that, not in these days, but originally you were inviting them into a confidence and stuff. And then, you know, having taken that risk, I think then I probably got more confident in taking on difficult things. So, you know, I'm never going to be one of these comedians that's going to sort of depress the shit out of everybody with like a tragic 5-minute story. But I certainly wasn't afraid to talk about the bad things that had happened to me, you know, however briefly, or if I had something funny to say about them. And just bit by bit, yeah, the sort of complicated balance of who you really are comes out. And for me, that balance is on the one hand, you know, having sort of centre-right politics, some small C conservative impulses, also being what most, you know, what certainly in old-fashioned sense would have been seen as liberal, and that no longer being seen as liberal, which I think a lot of people are in that boat, but also finding it funny that I'm this guy too. Like, I can see that I have certain old-fashioned ways of thinking about things that I surprise myself sometimes. Like, you know, like I used to do a bit on men, you know, couples having double-barreled names, you know. I just, the moment whenever a guy tells me that they've gone double barreled, I just feel like it. What makes me laugh is when he says, "No, we just," when he tries to act like he's okay with it. I'm going, "Come on, mate, come on." There must be a part of the, I say, "All right, you may have accepted the decision, but I'm going to bet that this wasn't your idea."
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
No, I get that. And I was interested when you were talking about the finding yourself funny and being able to take the piss out of yourself, because I think that's a very large part of your charm and charisma in comedy, is the fact that there's a knowingness about the fact that I know that what you're thinking about this. And how important do you have that? Because obviously it's not just comedians who listen to this podcast, it's people in business, and it's about helping people improve. Do you think it's important to actually laugh at yourself, to find yourself funny?
In some cases, what you're saying, it's not just laughing at yourself, it's acknowledging the funny thought about you that they may have had, you know. So a lot of comics use that device, and it's a legitimate comedic device of walking out and addressing what people's first thought about you might be. Yeah. Because what that does is it clears the elephant in the room, and it also shows them that you're good at it. You know what you're doing. I mean, the one I've used for a while, because I generally dress in jeans and a polo shirt, for a while I've sort of got the line and say, I reassured them I'm a comic, and then say, because I think some of you just thought an electrician had wandered on stage accidentally, because that's what it looks like, really. I mean, I'd look like an electrician for some reason, or the kind of bloke that, you know, you saw, you know, when it all kicked off at Wembley in the Euro final, I looked like the kind of bloke the kind of bloke there. So you, what I'm sort of saying is, I know that some of you in the room will think I'm a bit of a gammon in inverted commas, or, you know, I look like a hooligan, or you know, a lot of different things that aren't necessarily positive, but I've second guessed you. I've acknowledged them. And in the act of acknowledging them, I'm also confirming that I'm not, in a way. I'm not lumping an electrician in with blokes that have barged their way into a final and are being hooligans, you know.
But it's very interesting from a psychological perspective that we are all making decisions about everybody constantly. You know, they say that it takes between 2 and 3 seconds for somebody to make an impression. So actually, that's a very useful thing for anyone who has to get up, whether that's a wedding speech or a business speech or everything, to acknowledge something in the room about themselves or about the situation. And then that kind of takes control of it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it can do. I mean, contextually, those are... It's like, I mean, you could do it with a best man speech. I mean, one of the things, if you're a best man, I would always think that not everyone in the room knows who you are. There's probably a likelihood that a solid chunk of people will know who you are. So you could deal with that then. You know, if you're in business, again, you have to slightly temper the message, because if you sort of walk on and do a business speech and go, I know what you're thinking, you know, the bastard love child of Stephen Hawking and, you know, something like that, you know, again, it's so subtle. I mean, I'd imagine that the difference between doing a business talk or, you know, or addressing employees and stuff is similar to how I have to change it for when I'm going on a show like Question Time or something, where I know that a naked attempt to get a big laugh will just annoy people, frankly, because they go, well, one, there's a lot of people that not unreasonably are going, why is there a comedian on Question Time? Fair question. It's not for me to answer. Secondly, you know, they're taking this a serious thing and they want to take it seriously. So in those situations, I tend to sort of like offer humor, a nod towards the idea of humor can be just as effective, you know, like something that doesn't have an obvious rimshot punchline, but is just dropped in. And then people can almost congratulate themselves for realizing, you know, what you've said. But it also takes the pressure off the joke as well. Like what you would, as you know, what you would normally have with a punchline is the funniest word will come at the end of the sentence, right? Because there's the punctuation point of a joke. Whereas I sometimes think if it's a more formal setting, I'll sandwich the joke within something else to give myself a bit of leeway, whereby, you know, you can kind of then if it doesn't work, they're sort of going, did he do a joke there, or was that just it? Does, and it doesn't matter, because if as long as you keep your own internal settings okay, it's amazing how, you know, it's like when you do new material, if you don't believe too much that it's definitely going to work, if something bombs, if you remain calm and just go and do the next thing and it doesn't appear to have sort of bothered you especially, then the audience can feel calm too.
That's really interesting, because I say to people on stage, if you want anyone to go into any state, you have to go into that state.
Yeah,
first.
100%. Yeah.
And I was thinking about when you were talking about that, you were a teacher at a secondary school. That was all about state management, wasn't it? About you had to manage the state. And in your book, where did I go right? I knew the word right was in there, and I was just trying.
You probably, from your point, you probably think, where did he go wrong? You know, right. I mean, that's the inference.
Not at all. It's a great book, Where Did I Go Right? But also that whole thing about being a teacher is about having the right attitude so people don't mess with you. And is that not similar to the whole comedy thing of, well, you've got to walk on stage with an attitude and then people will behave?
Firstly, as a teacher, I would always, I mean, I don't dress very well in life, and it's a constant source of frustration for my wife. But as a teacher, I did make sure that I had a shirt, suit and tie, you know, every time, because teenagers, despite, I mean, again, this is one of these kind of liberal things now where people go, you know, teenagers are just as clear. And again, no, there's great things about teenagers, but they are very superficial, basic creatures. If you go in looking smart, they will respond very well to superficial signals, right? So if you look the part, that's one thing. And then I would just go in as though, you know, like I just expected to be listened to. And, you know, if they were chatty or disruptive, I wouldn't get annoyed. I would just, you know, I had a couple of facial expressions that would just be like, I cannot believe that you're delaying these amazing things that I have to say. Like, and then what would happen is if you could nail that, the kids would often go, sharp, because they would see, you know, this person that, and if you could get away with that, don't get me wrong, there were some classes where you really had, you know, it was just firefighting. But I just used to sort of set up some very clear things at the beginning of the lesson. You know, one of them was that they had to call me either Sir or Mr. Norcott, you know. So I gave them a choice, but the choice was still between two very formal things. But that wasn't my, you know, maybe that was the first time I realised it was a bit old-fashioned or certainly conservative with a small C. But to me, it was like classic conservatism, which is just pragmatism, is that that's what will work. That's what they need. That's not necessarily how I want to act. I would rather just be relaxed and wearing jeans and a t-shirt, but that's what I need to succeed in this environment.
That's really interesting, but you said it in as teenagers. I do a lot of training in business and people, and I'm always saying the same thing to people in business. You know, you think you work for a trendy company and you can wear a tall t-shirt. Well, when you're going to pitch to somebody outside, you've got to remember that they are judging you on some level. And whether that's a level of respect like you're talking about, it doesn't really make any difference. So it's easier to actually hold them, first of all, with the visual.
Or just don't scare the horses. I mean, that's the point, is it's like comedy. Any decision that you make with teaching or comedy to upset convention, if it's done with an idea in mind, like a real clear plan of why you're doing it, or like you might have the most amazing pitch in the world. Like you want to wrong foot them perhaps by looking like you look, or you've got jokes about how you look. That's great, but it can't just be like, oh, I can't, you know, because I can't be asked to wear a suit. It's got to be like there's a specific reason. You know, you might be a music teacher and think if I wore a suit, you know, they might think I was a bit uptight and therefore not, you know, necessarily a great music teacher. You know, being a drama teacher, being a PE teacher, all these things are. They're all different choices. So you can, you know, I remember there was a comedian, a very good comic called Danny Boy, and he came on and I did a gig with him in Singapore and I was sort of the support act. But when he came on, he faced the other way for a good 2 minutes. But he knew what he wanted to get out of that. It was a power play and a very high status move. But he had the jokes. He had the jokes about facing the wrong way, you know. But if you just face the wrong way because you think it'd be a cool thing and what you know, to see what will happen, you know, it's 99% of the time it's going to come unstuck.
Well, I think you're right. What you're saying is you have to be very, very skilled to do it. When Alan Davis first started doing comedy, I used to work with him all the time, and he used to come on shambolic, looking at, you know, the set and the thing and the thing, and the audience used to visibly get nervous. Because it was like, oh, you know what it's like at the store. Oh, God, he's going to be. And then he would do that for about 90 seconds and go up to the mic and go, oh, don't go thinking I'm shit. This is my job. I'm just doing, when you turn up for your job, you don't sit straight down and start doing
that.
And so, you know, and then he'd have a gag for that and a gag for that.
Well, it's just tension. Yeah, there's a deliberate thing there. You're creating the tension of low expectations. Which you can only exceed, you know. And there's something, you know, in talking about comedy from a more conservative angle, the thing that you can exceed is certainly when you're in Edinburgh and there's very like bourgeois type left-wing audiences, the low expectation is that they might think that you're a horrible or stupid person. And it's quite a handy one, that, because if you demonstrate to them that you're not thick or that you're not unkind. I've often thought, you know, with left wing, you know, this argument about left wing and right wing comedy, I think it's harder to be a left wing comic because you're sort of adopting a high moral stance from the beginning. And that's not necessarily a great place to do comedy from, is to say, I'm a fantastic person who thinks all the right things. Whereas if you just think about, you know, if you're thinking of a sitcom character, you know, I'm a flawed person who sometimes thinks the wrong things, is a much funnier, you know, place to come from. And you know, admitting to thinking those things or to kind of like sort of balmy things that run through your mind is again, like you say, it's about what's your intention. And you know, if you just, so for example, if you just went on to shock people, that won't work in the long run, because it's annoying when someone says, well, prepare for my truth, or can you handle this, or I bet you weren't expecting that. People go, well, we'll be the judge of that. But if you go on with the idea of you want to share some complicated ideas that are morally ambiguous with jokes, that's a different starting point.
I think it's fascinating.
I mean, I say all this, I'm making it sound very highfalutin. I mean, if you saw my club sets at the weekend, I was doing knob jokes, you'd think, well, where does all this theory feed into that, Jeff?
Well, do you know what? Sometimes you have to have a bit of both, don't you? And it's horses for courses, isn't it? Well, if you're doing a set in a club, you can't do it about philosophical matters to do with conservatism. You've got to have a knob joke in there to get it there. Talking about clubs, you talked about a couple of people, but what makes you laugh?
I think at the moment on things like TikTok, there's so many funny people. It's actually scary, like how good just generally people outside of what's perceived to be the industry are observing things and making funny sketches. I think that the skill set to be a stand-up, as you all know, is quite rare. It doesn't matter how many people start it. It seems like there's still only a certain amount that get good at it. But the thing of just noticing like little intricacies and inconsistencies in life and representing them in small sketch formats, I think there's some insanely funny stuff on TikTok. You know, there was a guy the other day that I saw a sketch, and he just said, when you're lying in bed and you can't tell whether or not the dressing gown hanging on the back of your door is your dressing gown or a 15th century ghost. Now, it was such a specific observation. He means in the dark. But because I'd once been in a hotel and woke up and saw my suit hanging up on the thing, and it was in that half sleep state, I just thought, yeah, you know, like sometimes when you're in a half sleep state and it's dark and you're maybe in a slightly negative frame of mind, and you think the things that you're, and he just did a very good impression of a scared person trying to sort of hide in their bed. And I just thought, God, that's such a simple, but it wouldn't work in stand up, you know, but in the realms of a short clip where you can demonstrate it, you know, it's really funny. And there are, you know, there's another guy on there that, you know, he uses higher production values, but he's just done this brilliant satire of the Kardashians, which is an obvious target, right? But he sort of picked up on certain linguistic tropes, the fact that they've always got like a weird drink with them, so he'll often have a glass that would just have like an exotic flower coming out of it. It's not even really a drink, but he's just picked up on the fact that they always seem to be promoting an idea that there's something new and fangled that you should be drinking. So it might be unfashionable with comics to say it, but yeah, social media, I think, is where I get my laughs now.
That's amazing. Do you think that, you know, we touched on it about political leaders, but do you think you can be a great communicator generally without understanding humour?
It's hard, really. I mean, unless the raw, dry content you have is so earth-shattering that it didn't need humour. You know, I mean, even Stephen Hawking used to throw in the odd gag, didn't he? You know, you're talking about the inception of the universe and the Big Bang. He would throw in the odd wry aside. I think that I never thought like a speech suffered from being too funny. I definitely thought that loads of speeches suffered from being too serious, I guess is the best way of putting it. So if you were going to veer on one, I mean, obviously, you know, we're talking about humor if it's successful now, right?
Yeah.
But you know, being serious can be successful, but it can also bore the crap out of you, you know? I think that if you look at somebody like Theresa May, you know, she suffered by not being able to loosen at all. Rishi Sunak as well will suffer from that problem. Starmer will suffer. I mean, look how much cut through Boris Johnson got just because he was sort of shambolic and a bit funny. You know, Blair could be, not to the same degree as Johnson, but Blair could be humorous. But if you look at all the recent prime ministers that have struggled to sort of strike up a rapport with the British public, it's been a lack of humour in a way.
You say that. We had William Hague on the podcast.
Well, he was great, yeah.
He's funny. He's genuinely very funny. And, you know, they used to say, Alistair Campbell used to say, and said on here, that they feared him at Prime Minister's questions, because he could do a zinger that would not only make the Conservatives laugh, but the whole Labour benches laugh as well. And that's a real talent. But William Hague said that Margaret Thatcher was deeply unfunny and didn't get it. You know, the story of her saying, is Monty Python one of us? Because they tried to get her to do a line that was Python-esque and say, Prime Minister, it will work. And when it worked, it said, is he one of us? You know, but she really didn't actually understand the rhythm of humour. And yet she was adored, was she not?
I suppose that's like goes back to that point about it. You better have the most earth shattering. Everything else needs to be in place then, you know, in terms of your image. You know, the Iron Lady, the gravitas, the way that she spoke, her uncompromising, you know, all the other stuff was in place. It's a bit like, you know, when people talk about doing dark humor, I always think that dark humor just needs to be funnier. You know, that's the point about it. So if you're going to be as serious as Thatcher was, you've got to go full Iron Lady, right? You know, there can be no, you know, and in a way that is the funny thing, is that someone has such utter, I mean, she just had such utter conviction. It was, it's almost striking in itself that you go, I don't think you doubt any of this. You know, some politicians where there's nuance, you know, someone like Ken Clark couldn't be more different from her. And people, public tend to like Ken Clark. He's one of those few politicians which cuts across with both sides. And that's almost exclusively to do with humour, you know, like Dennis Skinner, real hard left type guy, beast of Bolsover, but funny, right? You know, he's got running jokes and all those sorts of things. So I guess, yeah, some people do break that mold. I mean, it'll all depend on, I guess, and this might sound a bit trite to say it, but the subject matter and the context. And it's a constant balance out, isn't it? It's a trade-off between how serious or you know, kind of portentous or ominous is what I have to communicate here versus how much humour can I afford to have. You know, I mean, I've done, you know, unfortunately, I've done quite a few eulogies because people, once you're a comic, they tend to ask you to do them. And I've learned in a way that you do need to have a couple of nods towards humour, but they need to be tiny nods. And you know, the most you're going to get is a kind of, you know, a wry noise of a acknowledgement, you know.
I'm interested in that because the only time I've seen it done, which I think was brilliantly, was when John Cleese did the eulogy for Graham Chapman, where he took everybody down one road and then sprung it back.
Well, that was I guess that was a comedy industry funeral and there were comedians there. So that was much closer to being a performance than anything that we would understand.
Yeah, that's true.
As a funeral. I think the one that really stands out most to me was there's a moment in the, you know, that incredible speech by John Hannah's character in Four Weddings and a Funeral when his partner has died and
Stop the clocks.
So he does. He eventually does the poem, but before that, he does a kind of eulogy, and he talks about the. I can't remember what it is. He says something about the awful experimental sandwiches he would make, or something like that. And it cuts to this actress. I don't know who she is, but she does this sort of nod and a wry smile, and that was enough. That was exactly the right amount of humour for that situation, which was not very much at all. But you know, there are, you know, it's so contextual with eulogies. I mean, like I say, I've done them at all ages, sadly, but the older people are, the more you can mention stuff, you know, the more tragic it is, the less you can mention stuff. It's almost like there's a sliding scale and you just got to kind of, you know, again with weddings, you know, I was lucky enough to be the celebrant for my stepsister's wedding. And that was a great thing. I've never done that before. It was really, I'm surprised that more comedians don't do it, by the way, as a corporate offshoot, because celebrity comedian does your wedding is, you know, let's talk business, Paul, once we finish. But but to try and be too funny in that situation, like, don't get me wrong, I was able to do a couple of jokes, but to try and be too funny, there's that moment where you go, it's not about you, mate. You know, so that is another factor as well, is that humour, sometimes you can put yourself at the centre of something, but you've got to be careful about the degree to which you should be at that centre.
Yeah, brilliant. We've reached the part of the show, Jeff, which we like to call quick fire questions.
Quick fire questions.
Who is the funniest business person that you've met, so not necessarily a comedian?
I don't know if this was deliberate, but there was a guy that I worked with when I worked in advertising. He was an old East End barrow boy that ended up working on the kind of small industry side of thing with ITV. So his deals were often, instead of money, it was like contra deals. It was hilarious. He used to get like 30,000 pairs of jeans, you know, or six new photocopiers and stuff. And he was just a funny guy. I had a funny way of talking. And, you know, he'd pause it. He just used to instinctively make me laugh. And he just had a way of saying it where I was like, I never knew if he was being deliberately funny. And he'd be like, I got six brand new photocopiers out of them, you know. And it was funny because I was working for ITV advertising at the time. A lot of them were talking about these multi-million pound dollar deals. So yeah, maybe there's a sitcom in him. But yeah, in business, that would definitely be the funniest guy.
Oh, brilliant. What book makes you laugh, Jeff?
So I don't know, as a guy who used to be an English teacher, I don't read enough. But when I was younger, I remember Martin Amis's books. It wasn't like the laughter, it was the humour that used to build throughout the books. And then he had this knack for naming characters. And so there's the book Money, which is about a guy trying to get a film commissioned in the late 70s, I think. He has these characters in it that are just so fun. Like there's a guy who's kind of, I guess, like a Chuck Norris type, I don't know, Burt Reynolds type character, who's called Lorne Guyland. And I was just sort of so funny because immediately that's not like a real name, but it feels like a real name. And then he had this character, this kind of actress who'd become an earth mother called Kaduta Massey. And she basically just wanted to, you know, one of these highly intellectual women that wants to sort of breastfeed the entire world at the same time. And you know, at the time I was reading that, you know, it was at the time that Madonna was adopting half of Africa and stuff. And so he seems so ahead of the game. And in the book Money, there's a description of him losing a tennis match, which I think that there's something about losing at tennis, which is so humiliating and protracted and exhausting. And I think that he just captures every single aspect of it.
Oh, no, it is a tremendous book. And actually, you're the first person who's chosen that book, but it's a brilliant choice. I absolutely love it. I also love Martin Amis came up with one of my favourite sort of little quotes, and he says, I keep on working because I have tramp angst. He goes, I see myself under it. And do you have that same thing as well, where you visualize that if this doesn't go right, and then the I'll tumble into that, and next thing you know, I'll be under Waterloo Bridge begging for pennies?
I mean it's interesting because I always thought that was more of a working class impulse, you know, like if you've, you know, it's that old phrase about once you leave the council estate, you never stop running, right? You never stop running from poverty. I also had, you know, another guy in business that was a very funny man. He's and, you know, still works in comedy, Jeff Whiting, who you'll probably be aware of as well. Promoter and an MC, you know, and he has a real place within the comedy industry. But he had this phrase, you know, he said, comedy's like pushing a car up a hill. You know, he goes, you can get really far up that hill, but if you take your hand off that car for 1 second, like the velocity of the reverse. And it's annoying because that is what comedy's like. I absolutely tramp angst and stuff. But maybe with Martin Amis, the thing that substituted for poverty was the fact that his dad was Kingsley Amis.
But he still had that psyche
I have tramp angst as well.
Yeah. What film makes you laugh?
I guess like all people, it changes over time. I don't know. I can remember at the time, you know, I can say that when Dumb and Dumber first came out, I mean, I watched that on a loop a lot, you know, that formative. And obviously the spoof films of the kind of late 70s as well. Because what I loved about those spoof films was when you saw grown-up actors. And I just loved the fact that they were so deadpan and they were taking it so seriously. You know, and you get people like Leslie Nielsen and those guys that you just sense such a warmth, I guess. And then going on from that, people like Will Ferrell, I think, really carried that forward, where you just think you must be the best bloke in the world because you're willing to be so silly for the sake of entertaining other people. Like there's things in the film The Other Guys with Will Ferrell and Mark Wahlberg that's so ridiculously funny. Like in one of the running jokes in it is that he's got this stunning wife who's literally a 10 out of 10. I mean, 10 out of 10. And he's just a bit he sort of apologizes to Mark Wahlberg about his wife, her behavior, how she looks. And Mark Wahlberg's absolutely astonished by this. And then it also transpires that in a former life, he was a pimp as well, called Gator, which is short for alligator. It's just so funny in the way that it's executed. And it's the, you know, commit to the bit. That's the thing. And you go, obviously you got paid loads of money for that and became famous. But whenever anybody does deadpan, I always think that they're sort of making a sacrifice for everybody else's benefit.
Yeah. And that, but isn't that in comedy, you have to really go for it, especially on film. You have to sort of like believe that you are it for it to become funnier.
If you know what I mean. Well, they always say that about good comedies. You know, whenever they say about a comedy, we had great fun on set and there was loads of improv, and those aren't necessarily the best ones. The ones that you want are the ones that had a great script. And I know that with Judd Apatow films, often they'll think of lines in the moment and stuff. So there's a different kind of improv. But yeah, you don't necessarily want them to have had a complete laugh. You know, you want them to execute the script and the story as presented, and the humour tends to come afterwards.
I want to take a very quick shift to the other side. I don't know, you're going to be one of the most interesting people I think I've asked this question of, because I wonder if you have limits, but what's not funny?
As you'd probably expect, I don't have limits in terms of subject matter. You know, I see that not everybody has to think this way, but I think that comedy has, it's a risk, isn't it? To make a joke, it's a social risk. So all comedy is predicated around risk at some degree. The greater the risk, the greater potential return. And I think that you can get told off, you know, like if you made a joke and people didn't like it and it made them feel bad, it's okay for people to be angry about that and to share that with you. What I think's changed recently is what people think that the consequences of that should be, you know, and in some cases they think it should be, you know, being boycotted, losing commercial sponsors, or just never being seen in public again. So I think, I don't think that there are, you know, I literally don't think that there are any subjects that are beyond comedic treatment, you know, because I think that it doesn't sound like an art form, really, if you start saying you can't, like any sentence that starts with you can't. You think, is this an art form? Even when people talk about punching up and punching down, you go, well, you can only punch in one direction. But actually, if you know why you're punching down, and if you've got a way of pulling it back round to punching up, there's all sorts of, or if you know that in the process of punching down, the real joke is that you seem like an awful human being. There's always, you know, there's always a way to do something. So no, the short answer is, eventually the short answer is no, I don't think there are any limits.
I just thought that the whole thing about cancellations and people being cancelled is a really strange way, because who's deciding what this, and that's always what makes me uncomfortable, because we're going back to 1950s Britain.
Well, yeah, that's been the irony recently, is how many people don't realize, for those of us that can remember, how much like Mary Whitehouse they sound. That's the funny thing, is they think they're at the cool, trendy, cutting edge of society. We're going, but yeah, but telling people what not to say and that it's too rude or too provocative. I mean, that was literally what that's what the right wing used to say. That used to be the preserve of the conservative. So that's been an interesting thing culturally during the course of doing comedy, is to watch people essentially change places on that spectrum.
Yeah, it's fascinating. What word makes you laugh?
I mean, there's a group of words that I don't really think that there's a word for, but that sound more impressive than they are. So words like espadrille, if you think about how that sounds versus what it is, or gazebo, you know, mezzanine. All these words are like way grander than the thing that they describe. So I want to invent a word that describes words that are, don't really live up to their billing.
Placebo.
Placebo.
No, placebo is the new word.
Oh, placebo. Yeah, that could work. Yeah, they don't really perform a function. But yeah, I've always thought that was funny when you hear a word. Oh, well, what does that mean? And another one as well, just doesn't even sound like what it is, sound like bucolic. And you go, it's so close to bubonic, and that was a plague, whereas bucolic means beautiful countryside or something. I'm just, I don't buy it.
I love that. I love that. Any sound that makes you laugh?
I mean, well, look, I'm a boy at heart. I mean, actually, do you know what sound. You know, like the old 1970s type Carry On Laughing things, like if a guy would see an attractive woman and you'd hear a boing or like all those childish, ridiculous sort of postcard sexuality humor sounds from they used to get from Ealing comedies. Those make me laugh.
Brilliant. Penultimate question. Would you rather be considered clever or funny?
Funny, because whatever intelligence I did have, I would know that it'd be easier to get it across for me with humor. If I was clever without funny, you know, I don't know how you'd get an audience for getting an audience just for being clever is really bloody hard. Yeah. You've got to be so clever. Whereas getting an audience for being funny, you know, you could be pretty funny and you can get a bit of an audience, you know.
Brilliant. And finally, Jeff, desert island gags. You can only take one joke with you to a desert island. What is it?
Well, it would just be for sort of sentimental reasons. My mum, how this all started was my mum used to take me and my sister to Harrods once a year, you know, to show us how the other half lives, and we could get one toy, you know, within a certain price range. You know, just basically it was her way of saying, you're good enough, you know, your money's as good as theirs. And I had a book called the Ha Ha Bonk Joke Book. And the joke was something like, what goes ha ha bonk, a man laughing his head off? Now, not the greatest joke in the world, but I did tell it on stage at a holiday camp and it got one of my first laughs. So that one.
Nostalgia.
Yes.
Brilliant. Jeff, you've been a fantastic guest. You've made us laugh. You've made us think. Thank you so much for being a brilliant guest on the Humorology podcast.
And listen, I hope that your listeners, hope to see as many of them as possible on the Basic Bloke Tour, which is all around the country from February, the on sale from the beginning of February, and then it starts in autumn and we're going to all sorts of places. So I'm looking forward to getting back out there.
Go and see Jeff, Basic Bloke, brilliant bloke. Thanks a lot, mate. The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros, produced by David Rose. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.